Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
This program is supported by great listeners, including Patricia Player, Kathleen Lowy, David Mills, a new subscriber, and Joan Falber. You can get more information and sign up for a voluntary subscription at peterbcollins.com. In the second portion of this podcast, we'll talk about working at a public hospital in Chicago. But first, we go deep south.
The devil fools with the best laid plan.
For another update on the troubling saga of former Democratic Governor Don Siegelman of Alabama. We've been covering this story for too many years now. If this is the first time you've heard about the case of Don Siegelman, I suggest you go to peterbcollins.com and in the search window just enter Don Siegelman or Karl Rove, and you will see the many podcasts that we have devoted to this very serious set of issues. And to recap briefly, Don Siegelman had an election stolen from him. He was then indicted, cleared that the first time, was re-indicted. The case was driven by Laura Canary, a U.S. attorney appointed by George W. Bush, who is married to Karl Rove's former campaign business partner. And there's also a judge who should have recused himself, Mark Fuller, in the case, and many other interwoven issues related to the corrupt practice of justice in the state of Alabama, mostly driven by federal prosecutions. Returning to our program today is the former governor himself, Don Siegelman. Governor, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Peter, thank you. I want to make one parallel connection between California and Alabama. In 2001, 2002, the leading candidate for the Democratic nomination for president was Gray Davis from California.
Mm-hmm.
As you may remember, our friend Al Gore had decided not to seek that nomination after his loss, and Gray Davis was leading the pack. I was a friend of Gray Davis's. I was thinking about entering the Democratic primaries in the South as a stalking horse, as someone who would raised questions about George W. Bush's war policies, his education, economic policies. And the interesting parallel was that Karl Rove's one of his best friends, Grover Norquist, who has been connected to Karl Rove since college,
mm-hmm.
And is always involved seemingly in many of his Rove's dirty tricks, was both at work in California to do in Gray Davis and also at work in Alabama to cause me trouble and trying to defeat my education lottery, which is at the heart of this prosecution. At the same time, we had millions of dollars of Jack Abramoff's money rolling into Alabama to defeat me.
Right.
Another one of Karl Rove's good friends and bagman. And that led to to my investigation and indictment and my being brought to trial in my re-election campaign of most recently of 2006, mm-hmm. 1 month before the Democratic primary, by Karl Rove's best friend's wife. Keeping in mind, all of you listeners out there, I know this is terribly confusing, but Karl Rove's best friend was running my opponent's campaign while Karl Rove's best friend's wife was trying to get me indicted by a federal grand jury and then subsequently brought me to trial 1 month before my reelection campaign.
Well, Governor, we call that Republican family values.
Well, it's, you know, you could pass it off as a conspiracy theory, but the problem is we have sworn testimony by a Republican lawyer
right
before the House Judiciary Committee that she was hired by Karl Rove to investigate me during the campaign and that she was part of a telephone conversation. This is the Republican lawyer
mm-hmm.
who says that she was part of a telephone conversation when Karl Rove's best friend said, "Guys, y'all don't need to worry about Sigelman. My wife is going to take care of him." His wife, of course, being the U.S. attorney in the Middle District of Alabama. But anyway, we're beyond that now. The problem here is if they can prosecute me for what 91 former state attorney generals, 91 former state attorneys general from all over the United States, Democrats and Republicans, have said that what I did was not a crime, and I accepted a campaign contribution on behalf of the Education Lottery Foundation from a CEO of a HealthSouth corporation, and then appointed this guy to a board on which he had been appointed by three previous governors, and had this was his fourth term on this board, non-paying board.
Right.
And Grant Woods, one of the former state attorneys general for Arizona, is a Republican, was also the national campaign chairman for John McCain, said that the problem here was that the Republicans could not beat me in Alabama. This is a Republican attorney general, former national co-chairman of the John McCain campaign,
mm-hmm.
saying that the Republicans in Alabama could not defeat me fair and square, to use his words, so they targeted me with this prosecution. And this is, yes, it's about me and it's about my freedom, but it's also, Peter, it's also about your freedom and about Roger's freedom and about the freedoms not just to make contributions and the freedom to speak and the freedom to associate, the freedom to back people and support issues and causes that you believe in. But I think it goes deeper, because what Karl Rove did to this country, he subverted our constitutional rights, and he threatened the basis of our democracy by using the Department of Justice as a political weapon to steal elections,
mm-hmm.
simply for the purpose of maintaining his power base. And if we let this guy get away with this, and so far we have, and that's both Republicans and Democrats.
Yes, sir.
If we let Karl Rove get away with this, then it's just going to encourage more people who want to be like Karl Rove to do the same thing.
Also with us today is Roger Shuler, the intrepid blogger who has covered this case in great detail and continues to do so at the website legalschnauzer.blogspot.com. Roger, welcome back to our program.
Thank you, Peter. It's good to be with you.
And it's nice to have you on with Governor Sigelman. I've talked to each of you separately many times in the past, but I wanted to get you both to comment today on the ruling that came from the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta earlier this week. And Roger, you've posted a couple of times on your blog about it. But could you briefly summarize for our listeners what the Supreme Court ordered the 11th Circuit to do following its ruling in the case of Enron CEO Jeffrey Skilling, and what you feel they did or didn't do in response to that order from the Supremes?
Well, Peter, the Supreme Court had ordered a review by the 11th Circuit because they had altered the definition of the honest services fraud law And astonishingly, in this new ruling that just came out a couple of days ago, the 11th Circuit, in my view, pretty much just brushed that off. They mentioned the Skilling ruling a few times, but it just said that there was no because the government had had alleged a bribery scheme, which that the Supreme Court had said that honest services law only touches cases involving bribery or kickbacks.
Mm-hmm.
And the 11th Circuit said, well, the government alleged that in the Siegelman case. But, of course, the Supreme Court also said you have to prove that took place. And it's just to summarize briefly, you can go on and on, but basically they just picked up. They did their previous ruling, I believe, was in March of 2009, and I've not measured it exactly, but it looks like about three-fourths of this new ruling is just a repeat of what they did earlier.
So they just went into Microsoft Word, they cut and pasted from the old decision into the new one?
Pretty much looks like to me, Don might be able to, but it looks like they added a little bit about Skilling and they reversed on a couple of honest services accounts, which I think they'd already reversed on Governor Siegelman, and that was about it. And it looks like everything else is almost identical.
Governor, go ahead, please.
Yeah, it's, I know my lawyers would fuss at me for saying this, but the three-judge panel, there are three judges, same three judges I had before, pretty much ignored what the Supreme Court said. The Supreme Court clearly said that for a bribe to be a bribe, you've got to have this is like envelopes full of cash. This is a briefcase full of money mm-hmm. that you stick in your own pocket or you deposit in your own bank account. The Supreme Court made it absolutely clear that that's what they meant when they said bribery. And there is not a scintilla of evidence. In fact, the government did not even charge me with taking a single penny. This was a campaign contribution.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, this bribery charge does not make any sense. This is a case that should never have been allowed to even go to a jury. But as you pointed out, I had a judge who didn't like me because we had had political battles before, and I had embarrassed him when he was the district attorney in South Alabama. But you know, my faith in the criminal justice system, you're going to think I'm kind of nuts for saying this, is still not shaken. I know it's taken a long time, and it's going to take a lot longer, probably, and a lot more money for me to pay lawyers. But eventually, the Supreme Court will get this straightened out. Because if they do not, as these 91 former state attorneys general said, that it will imperil every contributor and every politician, from the President of the United States down to your local mayor and city council, because people, our political system runs on contribution. And you just simply cannot allow a jury to infer, as the 11th Circuit has done, allow a jury to infer that there's something criminal without any proof beyond a reasonable doubt that it was. And so I still believe that the Supreme Court will eventually get this straightened out, but it's going to take probably another year and a half to 2 years and lots of money to get this thing done.
And
but
Governor, let me just point out to clarify a point you made, that the exchange here that is alleged by the prosecution was not even for your own campaign account. This was money that you were soliciting for an independent campaign to pass a state lottery to support education. Many states have those, and similar campaigns have been run in countless states.
Peter, it's important at this juncture, once again, to remind people of Casino Jack. If you've seen the movie,
yep.
Casino Jack, they even in the movie they flip up documents showing that money from Jack Abramoff was coming to Alabama to protect the economic interests of the Indians, the Coosawhatta Indians,
yeah,
and the Indians with gambling interests, while they were pouring millions of dollars illegally into the state to defeat me and to defeat the lottery. I was trying to raise money so that we could give our kids, finally, the hope of getting a free college scholarship when they walked across the stage to get their high school diploma. So I was involved. I was on the opposite side of Abramoff and these Indian and the Indian casino owners who were pumping millions of dollars. Rove was involved because Rove wanted to see me defeated. He was using Abramoff's money to get at me and to try to and to try to make sure that I did not win re-election. He was using his buddy, Bill Canary, and his buddy's wife, the U.S. attorney, to further their political aims by investigating and prosecuting me.
So, Roger Shuler, you described the decision as both lazy and corrupt, and we touched on the lazy part. You said that almost three-quarters of it appears to be just copied from the 2009 ruling from the same three-judge panel at the 11th Circuit. Why do you argue that they're also corrupt?
Well, I think all sides in this, Peter, seem to agree that the binding law on this, particularly when it involves a campaign contribution, is a case called McCormick versus United States.
Mm-hmm.
And that case very clearly says that that a contribution of this kind is lawful unless there is an explicit agreement, and uses the word explicit. And but so that's the law, and yet Judge Fuller, who Governor Siegelman mentioned, when he gave the jury instruction, that's not the jury instruction he gave. Essentially, in my view, Governor Siegelman and Richard Scrushy, his co-defendant, were convicted of a crime that does not exist under the law.
Mm-hmm.
And this is indisputable, and the 11th Circuit kind of gets around this. If your readers can call up the it's on the web now through the miracle of the internet. You can call it up. It's like a 65-page opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And they go into this long debate about the meaning of the word explicit versus the meaning of the word express, which is all just a red herring, because the governor's lawyers argue that they didn't argue that it has to be an express written agreement, but they said it does have to be explicit, which is what McCormick says. And I don't see any other explanation when they ignore their own clear precedent other than to say that they're corrupt. I just don't, you know, that's why I use that term.
And Governor, what's your comment on the method that Roger just described here that the judges used to basically kind of rewrite terms to maintain your conviction?
I think you nailed it when you said to maintain my conviction. I think there's I've been a student of politics for a long time, and there is nothing extraordinary about political opposition being put under house arrest to keep them out of the political fray and make sure they're not a threat to the party in power. And I think that is precisely what Rove and his cohorts and the Canaries and others whom I will not name, but Roger has already named, have been doing. And I think in part the decision was made by the three-judge panel that they were going to uphold the conviction, knowing full well that when this goes to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court's got to straighten it out. They've got to go back to the McCormick decision that Roger referred to. You cannot allow juries just to infer guilt when the standard has been proof beyond a reasonable doubt that there was an explicit agreement. It doesn't give the jury the right to infer that there was an agreement.
Now, Governor, let me challenge you a bit, because earlier you talked about your faith in the justice system in this country and that you hope that with enough dollars and enough time here that the Supreme Court would rule in your favor. And on the face of it, I would hope that you're correct. I would hope that they are consistent in their precedent with Skilling and applying it to the Siegelman-Scrushy case. However, we're looking at a highly politicized Supreme Court, and absent in the near future the appointment of a new justice by President Obama, I don't have the same confidence that the Roberts-controlled Supreme Court would look at this in a clearly objective and non-political way.
Well, you know, I have got to maintain my faith that this will be straightened out. I've got to keep my spirits in a positive way, because I believe that what I do and what I say will impact a lot of your listeners, and I want to see us, you know, do something positive to straighten all this stuff up, not only to hold Karl Rove accountable, but to make sure that these kinds of prosecutorial misbehaviors, or criminal conduct, as Roger has called it, is less likely to happen in the future. And, you know, one of the ways that we can do that is by requiring, as President Obama wants to do, requiring that all interviews of defendants be recorded and be part of the evidence, trail of evidence that's required to be turned over to the defense. That would have stopped the shenanigans that led to my prosecution, led to my conviction, where we had a convicted felon who was facing 40 years in prison, and the government simply went to him and they said, don't you want to remember this the way we want you to remember it? And then after 70 interrogations, not seven, but 70 interrogations,
right,
this guy decided to sell out, and he said, yeah, you know, I remember it the way you want me to remember it. What kind of deal do I get? And they said, well, instead of 40 years, we're going to recommend that you get no time at all, and that's what they recommended. So, you know, we've got to stop the government from bribing felons to lie on the stand just so the government can make itself look good, or prosecutors can make themselves look good in the eyes of, you know, their constituents. And that's exactly what we had in this case. 60 Minutes, CBS's 60 Minutes, on February the 24th, 2008, exposed the government, exposed this corrupt wrongdoing on the part of the government in bribing this felon to lie on the stand. And, you know, we have that as part of our record. So, you know, I want to be hopeful. I want to keep my spirits up, and I want to believe that that this will be straightened out sooner rather than later. But I'm afraid it's going to take a while yet to get this matter cleared up.
Well, I do appreciate the power of positive thinking. Roger Shuler, what is your take on the prospects of a Supreme Court decision in favor of Governor Siegelman?
Well, I'm like Don on the point. I think I'm hopeful that the Supreme Court will get it right, and I think they almost are going to have to get it right. But my faith in the justice system is terribly shaken over this and other cases, like the Paul Miner case in Mississippi. And but we got this 3-judge panel in the 11th Circuit that just, you know, folks went down to Jacksonville, Florida for oral argument on this case, no telling how much in legal fees and taxpayer dollars, and they just did nothing. And it's just disheartening to see a case have to go to the U.S. Supreme Court when, as Governor Siegelman said, it shouldn't have even gotten to a jury in Montgomery, Alabama.
Yeah.
But it certainly shouldn't get past the 11th Circuit. I mean, they're supposed to be, you know, they have lifetime appointments. They're supposed to be fiercely independent, and they're supposed to be able to apply the law as it's written. And one of the ironies of this is these are all Republican appointees who, you know, we've all heard the phrase the strict constructionist. Well, they're not. As I just mentioned, they don't follow the clear McCormick jury instruction.
Well, that term has been redefined as strict obstructionist, Roger.
Maybe I misheard it all these years. But
now, take a minute, Roger, to explain what you wrote about in your blog about the 3-judge panel citing the split decision of the jury as a reason to suggest that there was, you know, active discussion of the case and appropriate deliberations.
Well, it's just one of many bizarre. Again, I would encourage your readers, if they have time, to read the whole 65 pages. But they essentially say justify the jury's weird outcome by saying, well, that indicates they considered everything carefully. Well, as you and I know, it could also mean they were clueless. and the 11th Circuit themselves seem to be following that same pattern. They're sort of, you know, they reverse a little bit here and a little bit there, but then they keep a lot of the main stuff, and that seems to be their. It's almost like a. I really think it's basically a cover up at the federal court level that they're trying to keep some thread of the conviction out there and to give some legitimacy to what happened in Montgomery.
Absolutely, Roger. That is you have hit the nail on the head. That is exactly what's going on here. They have to give the prosecution cover. They have to give Judge Fuller cover. Otherwise, the whole house of cards comes crumbling down. And they're sticking to their guns, thumbing their nose at the Supreme Court, basically. And it is my hope that we're going to appeal for an en banc panel, meaning that we hope to get five other judges to sit in with these three, and listen to our argument again. And it would be my hope that the entire 11th Circuit, made up of those eight or nine judges, would straighten this out. But clearly, what the 11th Circuit, what these three judges were doing, is just giving the prosecution and Judge Fuller some cover, and maybe themselves some cover.
And let me just address the Fuller issue, because as I've read about this and researched it, I'm very comfortable in the argument that Mark Fuller clearly should have recused himself from this case. But that is another issue that will fall on deaf ears, particularly those of Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia. These are people who've had clear conflicts of interest and failed to recuse themselves.
Well,
right. Go ahead, Governor.
Roger should answer this question, but I agree that that Judge Fuller should never have been on the bench. The case should have never gone to the jury. If it went to a jury, it should have gone, as Roger said, with the correct jury instructions. So the jury was there. They may have deliberated on whatever they wanted to deliberate on, but the fact is the judge had them focus on a jury instruction that's not legal, that's not supported by the Supreme Court. So back to you, Roger.
Well, I was just going to add to that along that line, Peter, that toward the end of this most recent opinion, the issue of jury misconduct and a tainted jury is raised by the Siegelman Scrushy lawyers, and pretty much across the board, the 11th Circuit just says, well, that was all harmless. The improper emails back and forth, I think somebody researching stuff improperly, the flirting with one of the FBI. You're probably familiar with all the alleged misconduct in the jury, and the 11th Circuit just said, "Well, that's all harmless."
What about the rehearsal of the witness and the intimidation, or actually the deal offer, the proffer that he received, which basically I construe as a tainted witness? Did the court review that issue at all?
Don, can you answer that? I don't recall seeing that.
No, they have not. That was all information that came up about a year after the sentencing. So that issue will be presented, if need be, in a motion for a new trial. So we've got to get a new judge in order to get a new trial, and so we've still got some obstacles to overcome. But first, we're going to go to the 11th Circuit, hoping that the entire 11th Circuit will straighten itself, and if not, we'll go to the U.S. Supreme Court. If that fails, then you guys are going to come put on your swamp boots and come see me in the swamps of Louisiana while we try to trial for the new judge, hopefully.
Well, that's a quick thumbnail of what your options are. So your current strategy is en banc at the 11th Circuit, failing that, an appeal to the Supreme Court, and then from there it would be a motion for a new trial. Is that kind of the theory?
Yes.
Okay. And, Roger, what else would you like to add about this 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, the three-judge ruling that just came down this week?
Well, one thing I could add quickly, Peter, is on the Fuller recusal issue, I believe they said that wasn't raised soon enough, although they don't explain very well. I think it was raised about as quickly as people found out the information. And of course, Don could address this, but as I understand it, a judge has an obligation, if he's got a conflict, to bring that forward and recuse himself without being asked, and particularly asked after the trial. And so that was part of it. And I just, this may sound a little extreme, but the Obama Justice Department has been such a huge disappointment that they're probably not going to do it. But I really think if this three-judge panel is being influenced by somebody external to this process, I think that amounts to obstruction of justice. I believe there's a federal crime called interference with the operations of the United States. I'm not sure the exact statute on that. But I think this could potentially be criminal activity involving these three judges, particularly if they are getting influence from someone external to the process. Mm-hmm. And that's where the real crime is here, in my view. It's clear that what Governor Siegelman and Mr. Scrushy did is not a crime under U.S. law.
Mm-hmm.
But I would hope that the public would really examine, look at this document, this 65-page document they turned out, see what a joke it is compared to what the real law is, and try to, best thing I know is to contact the Justice Department and say, look at these, what happened, what was going on with this three-judge panel, what were their emails, their phone communications like, because in my view, somebody is pulling their strings. And that's where the real story, in my view, lies.
And Governor, I'd like you to comment on that. And at minimum, isn't it fair to say that the Obama Justice Department and Attorney General Holder are not even pulling fair strings, open strings, to balance this out and bring justice in this case?
Well, yeah, you're exactly right. And I'm frustrated in part with the Obama administration on several levels. The Patriot Act, the torture, the fact that we didn't pursue those who were responsible for torture, nor did we investigate, why we got into Iraq in the first place. But I am concerned that the president has not replaced the Karl Rove prosecutor. I was concerned when President Obama said he was going to look forward, not backward. Karl Rove goes before the House Judiciary Committee. He was held. He was in under contempt charges. They had an opportunity to prosecute him because of a deal worked out with the White House. Rove was able to speak without being put under oath. Mm-hmm. And he was basically let off the hook. We had him on the ropes, and they let him go. And now we have the same prosecutor, the same team of prosecutors, who browbeat this witness, this felon, and bribed him into testifying against me, as well as doing all these other improper things. But I'm still facing the same group of Republican Karl Rove prosecutors that I was facing, back in the Bush administration. And one has to ask, why is President Obama, what power is there that would keep him from replacing this person who is under investigation herself for misconduct? Why wouldn't they just simply move this case to the Northern District of Alabama? Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't they move it to another district or bring in a U.S. attorney from another district? There's no reason for these prosecutors in this office to continue handling this case, and it's just making matters worse and, of course, a lot tougher on me.
Indeed. And, Governor, give us a quick sense of where things are for you financially. This has been a terrible hit because you're not able to work in your chosen profession, and you have hefty legal expenses. What has this cost you so far?
Well, you know, I think the greatest cost is, I've emptied my IRA, I've emptied every savings account, and I've spent $2.5-3 million in legal fees over the last, started in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been going on 10 years. But the greatest cost, I guess, yeah, you could say, well, the greatest cost is this guy has spent his life in public service, and I did want to enter the presidential primaries and oppose George Bush. That was taken away from me. But my greatest regret is that I was never able to fulfill my commitment to the children of Alabama and give them free college scholarships by establishing an education lottery in Alabama. And I guess the greatest resentment I have is that these people who were involved in stealing my election and prosecuting me, you know, cared more about political power than they did about the future of the children of the state of Alabama. And that is where the real tragedy lies.
Well, Governor, I want to thank you for joining us today for this update, and I'm going to put up a link to your website, donsiegelman.com, so people can keep track of your progress and also, if they're in a position, contribute to your legal defense fund. Is there anything you'd like to say in closing regarding this latest decision and your future legal challenges?
Peter, I want to thank you for getting Roger Shuler and myself on your program. But again, I would ask your listeners to keep in mind that if they can do this to me, they can do it to you, and that this is bigger than one person. This is a challenge to the constitutional form of government that we have. It is a subversion of our constitutional rights, and if they get away with it, they're going to do it again.
All right, sir. And Roger Shuler, a final comment?
Well, Peter, I would second what Don has said, and also just add that we need to figure out a way to hold our federal judges accountable. One of the problems here, you have judicial immunity, prosecutorial immunity, not just judges, but prosecutors accountable too. These people are not accountable. The trial court and the prosecutors at that level got away with misconduct. It goes to the 11th Circuit. Nobody holds them accountable. They released this ridiculous opinion the other day, and I'm about the only person out there saying just how absurd it is and showing how absurd it is. And I don't know what the answer is, but it's alarming. And it's the same way in state courts. They're unaccountable, too.
Mm-hmm.
You can't sue a judge for no matter how badly he cheats you. And you know, Don has had months of his life spent in prison that shouldn't have been. Richard Scrisci is there now and should not be. So I don't know what the answer is, but as Americans, we need to hold these people accountable and look at this issue of people being immune from misconduct because they hold certain positions.
Very good point. Roger Shuler, Don Siegelman, great to talk to you both today. Thanks for joining us. In the next segment of the Peter B. Collins Show, we return to the windy city of Chicago, from which I escaped in 1976. A powerful new book about a public hospital.
We have the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. We as the young wish to say in this song, God bless great America. We give thanks to the old for achieving their goal. It is now up to us, and we know we must build up a trust. And we want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear.
Protecting the sick, the hungry,
the people
who live in fear. And there are a lot of those in the great city of Chicago. A new book will take you there to the public hospital on the near west side of Chicago that was closed a few years back. And it was open for 78 years after they said it ought to be closed and rebuilt, just to give you an idea of conditions there. A new book called County is being published here in the late part of May. It's subtitled Life, Death, and Politics at Chicago's Public Hospital. Dr. David A. Ansell is the author and joins us today. Dr. Ansell, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Nice to talk with you. And I noted that I escaped from Chicago just for your benefit. I grew up in Cincinnati. I went to Northwestern. And I was a lucky guy who got a break and hosted a late-night talk show in Chicago back in the 1970s. And I escaped in 1976 and moved to California. And I ran away from the Daily Machine, from the humidity in the summer and the awful winters. And I still miss Chicago in a lot of ways. It's a great city and a lot of wonderful people. And you arrived from Syracuse, New York, to take up your medical residency at Cook County Hospital. Tell our listeners what it was like, your first glimpse of this facility, and what it told you about your future as a medical doctor.
Well, you're right. I came to Chicago. First visit was 1977, the year after you left. And I was with a group of medical students in upstate New York. I grew up in a small town there. And we grew up in the anti-war movement of the late 60s and 70s, and then found ourselves in medical school and felt that the issues of social justice that we felt were important and the social underpinnings of disease weren't really part of our medical school curriculum. And we wanted to go train at a place where that was undeniably part of our training. The other thing we wanted to do was stay together. We met in medical school. We really liked each other. We lived in a house together. And we said, why not try to train together? So we just put one place on our match list. There's a computerized match, and we matched at County. So we went there knowing what it was like, because we had come in the year before and before our internship and came to see it. And it was really unlike any hospital that I had seen before or after. Victorian hospital built in 1914, rising 8 stories out of the west side of Chicago, and really what you would describe as really decrepit conditions inside, just incredible overcrowding, mostly black but also Mexican population. It was the hospital for black people in Chicago for reasons of lack of insurance or discrimination or just feeling unwanted. This was the hospital of choice for the black population of Chicago. It was also politically embroiled with the Democratic machine, patronage, hiring, brinkmanship. It was just one of these, I would say, iconic places. All our professors told us not to go there. And we got the best training of a lifetime there, but also had our eyes open to really the relationship between race, social injustice, poverty, and health.
And Dr. Ansell, your powers of description are evident in the book, and allow me to read a couple of quotes here. Fantas Clinic was a Soviet-style yellow brick and cement ambulatory office building appended to the west side of the main hospital by a corridor. Gray city pigeons lined up side by side on the concrete ledges outside the Fantas casement windows that faced Harrison Street, as if mimicking the long lines of people inside the building. The lobby was clogged with patients, standing, limping, shuffling, sitting, on crutches, rolling in wooden wheelchairs, old, young, frail, pregnant. In every nook and corner, they sprawled on benches, jammed the elevators. They came to County to get outpatient care denied or unavailable elsewhere. 400,000 each year. This was the county that did not make the evening news or the TV shows. Regular people who just needed to see a doctor and had nowhere else to go. They waited hours, endured rude clerks, and inexperienced doctors like me. Lines ringed the clinic. They snaked down the hallways and around the corners. Lines for registration, for appointments, even longer lines for the pharmacy. The patients armed themselves with bags filled with food, here for the long haul. Everyone knew you had to wait at County. And later in the book, you quote a woman who went there for many years, and she said, on a couple of occasions, she went to the emergency room, and the wait was so long that she got better just while she was waiting and left and went home and never got any medical attention.
Yes. You know, all of this was true, and I'm sorry to say it's true today, even in a new hospital. You know, we fought to get that place rebuilt, but what we really were fighting for was just basic common decency for these patients, and no one else would tolerate a wait like this for care. But really, people had no choice. They had nowhere else to go. And when we talk about things like, oh, the patient wasn't compliant or adherent, or they didn't stay to be seen, you know, really it was quite shocking that anyone stayed around because you had to wait so long. And I describe it in the book, County, you know, these conditions, really just to demonstrate the notion that, you know, people think of urban hospitals as these, you know, trauma and violence and, you know, drugs and alcoholism. And really what it was just regular people who needed medical care for conditions for which, if they got treated, would prevent them from having premature mortality. And it was the indecency of all of it that made me write the book, because I felt people should know about it.
And you described the population served there as primarily African-American, with some Latinos. I remember Puerto Rican population was rather pronounced in Chicago in the 1970s, and there were Latinos from other nations who were moving into Chicago as well. And I think there are a lot of people, particularly my West Coast listeners, Dr. Ansel, who think that racism and segregation really were exclusive to the South. But growing up in Cincinnati and experiencing Detroit and Chicago and some of the other urban centers, I would argue that racism remains a serious problem, and that segregation is still a very significant issue that you can see both geographically and on a class basis.
I work today at Rush University Medical Center, which is really kitty corner to the old County Hospital. And it really struck me when I trained at County. Imagine coming down from Mars and saying, what is healthcare like in America? And you land on one side of Harrison Street in Chicago, and you're in a building that was built in 1914, clogged with people, sick, and all the people are black or dark-skinned. And if you happen to land your Mars spaceship across the street and report back, you say, well, it's a very nice here, people are getting great care, and everybody's white. And that would have been the situation back in the 70s. The fact of the matter is, there is the northern cities, racism is alive, it's institutionalized. It may not be the act of discrimination that goes on in a business or on the street, but there are large swaths of just about every urban area in the country, including L.A., that are what we call racially hyper-segregated. And it turns out that these communities that are often black, Latino, are characterized by not having services, not having grocery stores, not having shopping stores, but not having health clinics and hospitals. And the legacy of this, which is deliberate public policy over many years around housing, around schools, et cetera, has left 50, 60 years later health outcomes that are really quite shocking even today. And so while I describe what happened between 1978 and 1995 at County, as most of the goes on in the book, today in Chicago, a 16-year-old in a Southside neighborhood has a 50% chance of living to the age of 65, 50%. And in most other urban areas, it's just as bad for black teenagers. And nationally, for a white kid, it's 80%. And that should shock all of us that we allow it. And when you dig down deeper into it, it's for lack of access to care for common medical conditions like heart disease and cancer, and that we have this premature mortality to this day. That's a legacy of racism and institutionalized racism that I discovered as a young intern at Cook County. I have to say, you know, I was shocked when I went there, and for the years that I was there, it was, how do we make it better? You know, what could we do to make it better? Was all what we all worked on, and even to this day, I'm sit on the board of the institution, and how do we make it better? But it's an overwhelming problem, and one of national scope. And while the book County is a microcosm of it, it really speaks to this, our national failure to address the inequities that exist in our society that lead to premature death. And that's what I find, you know, so abhorrent, and why I wrote the book.
And Dr. Ansel, I appreciate that you referenced a critical event that occurred before either of us was in Chicago, and I did cover the trials that followed the state-sponsored killing of Fred Hampton, the Black Panther leader, who was gunned down on the West Side in a raid by Chicago police that was coordinated with the FBI under the COINTELPRO program. And it really was an event that vividly showed the institutionalized racism and the real fear of the white establishment of black power movements at the time. And if I may quote again from your book, "We viewed the attacks on the hospital through the lens of Chicago's racial history. Because county hospitals serve black people, Latinos, and the uninsured, we believed that the hospital and its clinics would never receive enough resources or generate the outrage from the civic community to repair the conditions there. We were angry and determined to take matters into our own hands. The hospital was in decrepit shape. Quality of care was spotty. Over 50 years earlier, in 1927, the American College of Surgeons called for the hospital to be rebuilt, and now it's slithered towards closure. No replacement in sight." And so you really are, very conscious of these institutionalized factors and the ability of the average white person who has a job and owns a home in the suburbs to be completely oblivious of what goes on. I went to the Circle campus of the University of Illinois for several years, right next to the complex there, never set foot in county because I knew what the reputation was, and I knew that that's not where a suburban kid like me would go to get care.
Yeah, there's this concept called agency that basically could be summarized as things don't happen without a reason. And that when you look at structures or the structure of society, you got to say it's happened for a reason. And a lot of what was going on in Chicago and other cities occurred in terms of racial segregation, for example, occurred directly as a result of public policy. And that public policy, as I mentioned before, included redlining of neighborhoods so people couldn't get mortgages, the inability to move into other neighborhoods, crowded schools, you know, factories that moved out of a neighborhood, so jobs left. So it is, for as a white person from upstate New York, really a fairly naive kid, coming to Chicago was a real eye-opener and made me have to think about the structure of society and systems and say, well, how did this happen? Did this happen just by chance, or did it happen because of deliberate actions and policy? In the end, it happened because of deliberate acts of public policy. And almost like the glimmer of a star we see reflects an event in the universe that happened many years ago. Today, we're living the same issues that I write about in my book, County, and the consequences of it. So the health outcomes in the United States, the racial disparity and health outcomes that I mentioned before, they own their roots to this legacy of segregation and institutionalized racism that most white people don't see. I just I describe in County about me, you know, patients telling me in my practice, and I do it to this day. If I have a medical student with me, excuse me, and a black man, tell me what is when you get stopped by the police, what you do. And, you know, I grew up, and I was never taught anything by my parents except to respect the police. But in Chicago, you know, every black man knows when you get stopped by the police that you go through a ritual, you know, and the ritual is a hands up, you know, either over your head or on the steering wheel. You know, and again, the white kids are shocked growing in the up in the suburbs of Chicago. They've never really experience it, and sometimes by hearing the patient's stories, you understand something more about the structure of society. So,
I'm not disputing what you just said, but I have an anecdote that is slightly contradictory. My first trip to Chicago without my parents, I drove with a buddy, and I was on the Congress Expressway westbound. And I started to see this post office building there, and then I could see that the Eisenhower Expressway, the freeway, just, you know, seamlessly went from there. So I made a U-turn, and I was pulled over by two of Chicago's finest, who proceeded to talk to me very crudely and rudely and threaten me with an overnight in the Cook County Jail if I didn't cough up some cash for them. And I told him I only had $35 and I didn't want to insult them. And they said, "You're here from Ohio and you've only got $35? They were really let down that I wasn't, you know, a little more flush. And I did survive that without spending a night at the Cook County Jail. But it was my introduction to the Chicago police. And so I consider them to be above racism at that point. They just hated everybody.
Yeah, and I think that, you know... You're probably right that that was not a unique experience, but differentially,
yes.
I think how it's experienced it has been different over many years. And
no doubt about it. And while I mentioned the Cook County Jail, B.B. King did concerts there for a number of years, and you were assigned to work in the hospital at the Cook County Jail for a period of time. Describe that and compare it to County.
Well, unlike outside of jails, you know, jails are filled with people who've been charged with crimes but not convicted. So they have all the rights of citizens, plus the state is obligated to provide health care. So the only people in this country with universal health care as a matter of a right are congressmen and people in jails. So we were the health care for people in the Cook County Jail, and it was, quite primitive what we had, and we were, in those days, not supervised. And we weren't supervised in much of anything we did, and I described that in County quite vividly. But in the jail, we were even less supervised, and you were just were the only doctors there. You know, the jail is probably as old as the county hospital. And, again, people in need of medical care. And I think I described a situation of someone brought in dead from the jail block and me going up and doing an investigation with the resistance of the guards there. But we finally decided that this was just unacceptable. We couldn't get blood tests, and we did a work action. And that led to the professionalization of the physician staff there.
Mm-hmm.
But it was quite a difficult situation to be in as a young physician, but eye-opening at the same time.
Dr. Ansel, one of the practices you describe in the book that is very troubling and has grown worse over the years is patient dumping, where a for-profit hospital, or at least one that might be operated as a nonprofit, but that's not a public hospital, will either release patients or refuse to admit them in the beginning because they don't have insurance and they don't want to carry that load. And so county hospitals like Cook County have more and more become dumping grounds for patients who are not attractive to the, you know, what is now a fast-growing commercial industry, the for-profit delivery of hospital services.
Yes, that was quite prevalent, I describe in county in those days. And that was the norm and the expectation that if you were uninsured and you showed up in another hospital, that county should take you. It was the the unspoken rule. Actually, many people even spoke it, and that people would be transferred there for that reason. We just took it in stride and felt like this was just the way of the world until one day the numbers got so high we said we should do something about it. And we began to track this and wrote a paper, and eventually actually the law got changed, so it is actually illegal to transfer a patient for purely economic reasons who could be treated in another hospital. Now, and the number of these patient dumping events have gone way down.
And is that a state or federal law?
That is a federal law.
Really? Okay.
Yes, but, you know, hospitals have figured out ways to get out of around this. So one is by ending certain services,
right?
Like not doing trauma,
mm-hmm.
and not doing neurosurgery and not doing OB services. But if you think about it now, the biggest problem we have in our healthcare system is not hospital care. It's really outpatient and ambulatory care. And so there's a lot of what I would call ambulatory dumping now, whereas the inpatient problem, after our paper, that pretty much got reduced by law for those patients in emergency condition with emergency conditions. For those with the non-urgent but the critical kinds of things, a woman with breast cancer, someone with rectal bleeding, someone with bad diabetes, these patients really don't have places to go, and the public hospitals around the country are just really being inundated with the uninsured. There are 50 million uninsured in this country with nowhere to go. And people don't need hospitals like they do. They need regular doctors and primary care. And that's the real deficiency. And I think sort of the driving force behind the high mortality rates that we see both in black people compared to white people, but also the uninsured compared to the insured. And that's what the public hospitals were there for. But as I write in my book, County, you know, public hospitals were necessary but never sufficient to manage the load with the resources that were provided. And, you know, when someone had an emergency condition, we could take care of them quite well and quickly. But if you had a chronic condition, those were the people who got delayed, you know. And those led to, you know, the deaths that we see now are chronic disease deaths. Heart disease, hypertension, diabetes, breast cancer, colorectal cancer, and that needs access to specialists in outpatient settings, and that's where the dumping's going on nowadays.
And Dr. Ansel, as I read your book, it reminded me of a grisly cycle, and you describe late in the book the experiences of a woman who delivered a child or two at Cook County Hospital. And it was nearly barbaric, the situation she described. And she said she felt like when they handed her her baby, they were tossing her a slab of meat. And the conditions really strike me as third world. But that's the beginning of a life cycle that when you include poverty and a lack of access to the resources one needs to be upwardly mobile, then you see that children born at Cook County would drop out of high school, would have not much of an employment future, would turn to the drug trade to support themselves, making them vulnerable to the street violence that is endemic. And so you would see people cycling through Cook County Hospital at the various stages of these social pathologies.
Yes, I think that woman is one of my patients, and still is my patient, and she came to County in the 1950s, and she was describing what it was like to deliver a baby there. But we're now 60 years later, and I would say the conditions at the hospital are better. We have a new shiny new facility. There's attending physicians now who supervise. I mean, when we got done with our residencies and decided to stay on, we decided we were going to provide a different type of care, and that's really persisted now into the present. But what you raise is there is a vicious cycle, and that's really consistent through the scene, which is no matter how much was provided, it was never enough. It wasn't. It was not what people needed, and the waits were too long. You know, the people were rude. The delays were to get in to see the specialist were too long, and these things lead to the cycles of ill health that lead to again higher mortality rates in really the richest country in the world, which is. And in a city like Chicago or L.A., world-class cities where you have subgroups of the population who will die simply because they don't get equal care. It's so abhorrent and in some ways unjust and perhaps even undemocratic, unfair, that death or early death should be the price that someone has to pay simply because they're poor or in some situations undocumented. Black or Hispanic or white, it's just unjust.
And doesn't it send the clear message that it's as if there's a sign over this public hospital that says all who enter here are deemed disposable by the larger society?
I think there is an aspect of that. You know, we really cared about our patients, the doctors and the nurses to this day, really care about the patients who come there and really do their best to provide great care to them. But insofar that you can't provide the kind of services you need to patients because they're either denied or delayed, there is something. We have a tiered system of health care in which those with the best insurance can get the better services and then have better outcomes. And there's a gradation of services all the way down to the uninsured, where we've really neglected the uninsured. I think it's 45,000 excess deaths a year just for being uninsured in this country. And the black disparity ratio is about 80,000, the mortality difference. In Chicago alone, because of disparity, there's 3,200 black people die in excess each year simply because they don't have the same health outcomes as white people. And in county... And the county hospital is the failure of the public health system to provide, not the individual providers, not the nurse at the bedside, not the doctor at the bedside, but the system has led to these terrible outcomes that are measured in mortality rates in the communities.
And Dr. Ansell, you were a bit of an inside agitator. In 1979, the hospital ran out of money. You didn't get paid for a while. And you became perhaps an unwilling leader of doctors who were attempting to deal with Cook County government to get to get the budget so you could meet payroll, but also to try to deal with the long-term neglected problems there.
Yes, I guess you could call me that. We, you know, this was... What we were fighting for was common decency. And I wouldn't say I was a leader any more than anyone else in that setting, but you couldn't be there and not be moved to either resignation or action. And there were just a group of us that were motivated to action. And so we would take care of our patients during the day and go down to a demonstration and wave placards in front of the county building and then come back to work and... we just felt it was us against the world and that nobody really cared about this group of patients. And so, you know, faced with the choice of doing nothing or doing, you know, I, along with others, chose to do.
Mm-hmm. You also at one point came close to unionizing the doctor's staff there at Cook County Hospital. Tell us that story and who ultimately thwarted that effort.
Yeah, when I was a medical student, one of the attractions of going to county was that there was a house staff union, and there had been a strike by the residents, the trainees, a few years before we got there. And so we were all unionized when we were there, and we saw what the benefits of having a union and the protection that it provided for us and the ability to work collectively around issues. So when I became an attending physician, there was a doctor who was fired because he was HIV positive. It was the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. And I talk about this in County, my book. We said that we got to do something about this. And one thing we thought we could do was organize into an attending union. Well, that was, of course, opposed by the county. But we felt that we had a good chance of winning this and put in a long campaign, got people to sign cards, had more than enough cards to form a union, but it was taken to the state labor board who had three representatives on it. One was from the governor, James Thompson at the time, a Republican. We knew he wouldn't have that vote. The mayor at the time was Harold Washington, the first and only black mayor of Chicago,
right.
A time of reform in Chicago, and he had an appointee on there. And while the county Democratic machine was Democrat as well, we thought we might be able to win that vote from a Harold Washington appointee. The third vote was from labor, and we were sure we were going to have labor's vote. But in the end, we lost the vote at the labor board. The hearing officer, the staff said we deserved to be in a union, took it to the labor board. The county appealed it to the labor board, and then we lost 1-2. The Harold Washington Democratic mayor's candidate voted for us. The Republican voted against us. And then the union labor rep voted against us. And what we hadn't realized years later, I was on the phone when I was running a clinic at county with the head of the union. It was SEIU, which is a major national union.
Sure.
They're born out of Chicago. And I asked him, I said, do you know why we didn't get the union? He said, you're damn right I know. I didn't want you to get the union because you brought an outside outfit into Chicago.
Yeah.
So we were defeated by labor clout.
Well, the machine was formidable, and the labor mechanisms attached to it were very powerful and very turf conscious. And I had some of my own experiences with that in Chicago as well.
Yeah.
Dr. Ansel, you moved on from Cook County after 17 years. You were a top clinician at Mount Sinai, and now you are the chief medical officer at Rush University Medical Center. So you have a wealth of experience starting at the public hospital level. And I'd like to get your thoughts for a moment or two here on the efforts to reform health care. And I'm part of the 70%+ who aren't happy with the health care reform that Republicans deride as Obamacare. But I'm unhappy for different reasons. And when the Republicans cite that widespread lack of support for it, they fail to note that more than half of those who say they don't support the president's efforts felt it didn't go far enough. And I'm one of those. And by bypassing a single-payer option very early in the legislative process, by kicking out the fuzzy but hopeful public option later in the process, by cozying up to the for-profit delivery systems, the HMOs and others, the insurance companies and Big Pharma, I believe what was accomplished was thrusting hundreds, tens of millions of Americans into the arms of the insurance companies without any rate protection. And the real reason that 50 million Americans don't have health insurance is they can't afford it. And so I'm very frustrated by what has occurred because they had a shot, they took it, and they got about 20%, in my estimation, of what was really needed to radically realign our healthcare delivery system in this country. That's my view. Tell me yours, because you're on the front lines.
Well, I stated them in County, the book, and you couldn't work at county without saying that our health care system is unfair, and I think inherently unfair. And when you think about what would make it fair, it's not what we're doing now. It's not the health care insurance reform that we've put in, which I don't support either. Only a single-payer system, one that provides really the same card to everyone, that you can go anywhere and get your care. It doesn't solve all the problems, but it provides a level playing field around health care. That's the only thing that's going to drive the inequity out of our system. My mother and father, he's passed, but my mother is on Medicare 1965, suddenly made health care for people and the elderly. Everyone has the exact same card around the country. Now, you can complain about Medicare and this, that, but you know what? No elderly person would ever want you to take their Medicare away. That's a single-payer system. And I support a system that's like Medicare for all. We have a complicated health care system, and when you set up different tiers, as I mentioned before, you get every system is designed to give you the results you get. And if you set up tiered systems of payment, you will have different levels of care for different with the different people with the different payment cards. And you're going to set up unfair systems. And I don't think that's right. And so that's my critique of the health care reform. I'm happy that we have something rather than nothing, but it's not what I would want. I don't think it's best for the country. It's certainly not cheaper. As you say, even people with insurance are struggling to meet copays. I see it every day in my office, uninsured patients, patients who've lost their jobs. So it's not just the poor this is unfair to. It's unfair to everyone, including businesses that have to pay more than you would do, for example, in another country. We are twice as expensive as the next most expensive healthcare system, three times that of the one after that. And we can do a lot better, cheaper. And a single payer is the way. And I outlined that in my book. That was the conclusion I came to. But I have to say I went there with that conclusion that universal health care of some form was important. And I left with that, and now 30 years later, I still have this exact same conclusion.
And Dr. Ansel, just this week, Senator Sanders of Vermont, Congressman McDermott of Washington, have introduced a new single-payer proposal. And it's going to be a long struggle, but I support their effort. The Nurses Union here in California has been a major player and architect of that legislation. And I want to see physicians join into this. There is one group, Dr. Margaret Flowers and her group of physicians are supporting this single-payer proposal. But I think we need to see more docs on the front lines of this debate. I didn't really see enough from the medical profession in 2009 and 2010 as the legislation that did pass was being shaped.
Yes, there's a group that I'm a member of called Physicians for a National Health Program that does support actively single payers. But the other medical groups around the country are more lukewarm to it. There's a lot of interest at the table, and the interests have to do with how money is divided up around the profession and the institutions and the insurance industry. But if you take a step back and say, what's best for the American people, for all the people, it would be some sort of universal system, single-payer type system. That's the only way to do it. And I would urge doctors out there to join in and join the Physicians for a National Health Program, because that's the, I think, the leading organization promoting single-payer health care in this country.
And I do believe that is the group I referenced that Margaret Flowers is with. She's the one who got arrested in Senator Baucus' committee.
Yeah, that was with Physicians for a National Health Program.
Right. She's terrific.
Yeah.
Well, Doctor, I want to thank you, and I recommend your book. I really enjoyed reading it, and you, I think, have a great writing style that really takes people into your experience. And my final question to you is, having spent 30 years in the medical profession and 17 years at county, do you recommend this to young people today? Is the medical profession something that you would pursue if you were 19 today?
Absolutely. This is the greatest profession to be in, to be in a situation where you can really help people, I would say, you know, you should go in it because you love to take care of people. You should go to our public hospitals and train and come to our inner cities and rural areas where we have real problems with access to care. You get so much more out of this than you give. I'm so privileged. I never suffered one day for, you know, everything I outline in county, not one day of my life, all the cumulative day of my life were not ever as bad as the patients' lives and the dignity and the strength with which they live their lives has taught me so much as a human being. And I don't get people who complain about being doctors. I just don't get it. And I would say all my colleagues and I who I talk about in my book, County, and trained a county with me, would say the same thing. So for young people out there, if you have the passion for it, do it. Don't be deterred. My daughter's a medical student and loves it. And if I'm going to say this, if you're doing it for the money, you're doing it for the wrong reason. You got to do it because you have something to give and you care about people and their circumstances, regardless of how much money they have and whether they can pay or not. And I have no regrets 30 plus years later.
David A. Ansel, MD, the author of County. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening, and do me a favor, share this podcast with a friend or 10, and email me, fullofit@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.